After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who's been born King of the Jews? We saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him." When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. When he had called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them where the Messiah was to be born. "In Bethlehem in Judea," they replied, "for this is what the prophet has written. But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for out of you will come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel." Then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, "Go and search carefully for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me so that I too may go and worship him." After they had heard the king, they went on their way, and the star they had seen when it rose went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route. When they had gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. "Get up," he said, "take the child and his mother and escape to Egypt. Stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to kill him." So he got up, took the child and his mother during the night, and left for Egypt, where he stayed until the death of Herod. And so was fulfilled what the Lord had said through the prophet, "Out of Egypt I called my son." When Herod realized that he had been outwitted by the Magi, he was furious, and he gave orders to kill all the boys in Bethlehem and its vicinity who were 2 years old and under, in accordance with the time he had learnt from the Magi. Then what was said through the prophet Jeremiah was fulfilled. "A voice is heard in Ramah, weeping in great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children and refusing to be comforted because they are no more." I'm sure God will bless the reading of his word to us.
Well, good morning, everyone. I did make a bid for escape just then, but I was recaptured and brought back. So, last week we heard about the birth of Jesus, as recorded in the first chapter of Matthew. And this week we continue with Matthew's narrative in chapter 2. And he's left out quite a chunk of the story, because there's no mention of the manger or the shepherds, or why Mary and Joseph had gone to Bethlehem at such an inconvenient time. We have to go to the Gospel of Luke to fill in that part of the story, so come next week if you want to hear it. Matthew plunges straight in, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea. So, switch it on. Who on earth were the Magi? Well, probably most of us know what a shepherd is, but who were these visitors? Matthew's quite reticent about them, possibly because in Roman times they were well known and needed no explanation. The NIV merely says, "Magi from the east." That's the original Greek word, magos, in the plural. The NIV doesn't try to translate it. What a cop-out. Some translations, however, say wise men. Others say a band of scholars or astrologers. The one thing they're never called is kings. Now, I'm very sorry to the Spanish church, but that idea seems to have started in about the 10th century AD, in the Middle Ages, when they're first shown in paintings with crowns on their heads. We're going the wrong way. There we go. That's a typical picture by somebody who lived in the later Middle Ages, and you can see they've got the crowns on their heads. It's not come up very well on the screen, but you've got three people who are the three kings. But sources outside the Bible mention the Magi quite a lot. In fact, they crop up all over Asia. So they could have come from almost anywhere. And they were probably followers of the Zoroastrian religion, which was prevalent in the Persian Empire. And sometimes the word Magi is used to mean anyone of that religion. In fact, it's actually mentioned in the Quran, alongside Jews and Christians. But it does seem that the Magi were a particular group of learned men who were always associated with the study of the stars. And we met them when we were looking at the first part of the book of Daniel. If you remember, at the end of last year, they failed to interpret the king's dream. And Daniel had to come to their rescue, or Nebuchadnezzar would have had them all executed. And a similar thing happened in the reign of Belshazzar, when all the king's wise men could not read the writing on the wall. So a great mass of legend has grown up around the Magi, not least the idea that there were three of them. They brought three gifts, but that doesn't mean there were only three of them. The tradition in the Eastern Christian churches is that there were 12. There's a 3rd century sarcophagus now in the Vatican, which shows only two Magi. Well, maybe the sculptor didn't have room to put any more in. Rob said the mason probably didn't have a wide-angled chisel. But three is the traditional number in the Western churches, and they have been identified as Balthazar, Melchior, and Caspar. The earliest record of these names is a Greek manuscript composed in Alexandria in around 500 AD. And this is actually a mosaic from Ravenna in Italy from 565 AD, so not long after that. And you see there are three of them. I don't know if you can make out just along the top, they've got the three names. And what about those trousers? Aren't they wonderful? And in an early example of political correctness, Balthazar began to be portrayed as a black man. That was from the 12th century onwards. But the Syrian and Ethiopian churches have other traditional names, and the Chinese Christians think that one of the Magi was Chinese. And they actually call him an astronomer called Liu Shang. And just to finish the story, tradition has it that the bodies of the Magi were found by St. Helena and taken to the church of St. Sophia in Constantinople. Now, St. Helena was the mother of the Roman Emperor Constantine, and she seems to have been a one-woman time team digging things up all over the place. Later on, the Magi were moved to Milan by order of Constantine. And they finished up in Cologne in the 12th century, and Cologne Cathedral was built to house the relics. But Marco Polo, remember him? He was claimed to have shown their tombs in Sava, a town south of Tehran in Iran. So you pay your money, you take your choice. All the Bible says is, Magi from the East. So why did they turn up? Well, we have their own explanation for this. Where is the one who has been born king of the Jews? We saw his star in the east and have come to worship him. So this is where the astrology comes in. The Magi had seen something special happening in the sky, and they understood it meant something important was going to happen on earth. So what did they see? Well, some have suggested a comet, possibly a supernova, which is a star that's dying, that sort of explodes, creating a very bright light temporarily. Or it may have been two planets coming so close together as to appear to be one bright star. And if you look this up in Wikipedia, you'll find all sorts of possible explanations. But it may not have been a celestial event at all. It may just have been a pattern of the stars, which had meaning for the astrologers. After all, no one in Judea seems to have noticed anything significant in the night sky. But notice that the Magi refer to the king as being already born. It seems that they saw the star at the time of Jesus' birth and set out to find him. But they had a long way to go and did not arrive until sometime after the birth. Verse 1 says, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem. Well, they probably travelled on camels, like the Christmas cards show, which is a good way to cross the desert, but quite slow. And they probably had servants, maybe guards, on foot. Remember, they were carrying treasure. But why did they bother? They could have sat in comfort and watched the drama in the sky and talked and speculated about it. Someone would have written a learned paper and got it published in Astrologer's Monthly. This group felt compelled to do something about it, to make the effort to go to Jerusalem. T.S. Eliot has written a poem about that journey, talking about the camels getting sore feet and lying down in the snow, and the camel men cursing and grumbling and running away, and the nagging voices saying, "What a foolish quest this was." A hard time we had of it. What was so significant about a newborn king of the Jews? Judea was a small province of the Roman Empire, just a small backwater. Now, if they'd gone to Rome to greet a new Roman emperor, it would have made more sense. I think there's a lot about this story that we don't really understand. But weren't they a bit daft going to Herod? Well, actually, they didn't go to Herod. Matthew says they came to Jerusalem and asked where the newborn king was. And Herod got to hear about it and was disturbed. Now, there are several kings called Herod mentioned in the Bible. This one is generally known as Herod the Great, who started the rebuilding of the temple. And he wasn't Jewish at all. He came from Idumea, a territory to the south of Judah, which had been occupied by people from the old kingdom of Edom. And Herod had been appointed king of Judea by the Romans, which didn't go down well with the Jews. He was totally ruthless, responsible for the murders of his wife, three sons, mother-in-law, you might understand that, brother-in-law, etc., etc. But his position was precarious. He was only kept in power by the Romans. And he would know that the Jews were waiting for the coming of the Messiah. Suppose this baby really was the promised Messiah. Well, then Herod was likely to be deposed. So Herod asked the chief priests and teachers of the law where Messiah was expected to be born. And they came up with a passage from the prophet Micah, which had been written 700 years previously, which mentioned Bethlehem. And that was a village a few miles south of Jerusalem, birthplace of King David. Now we'll find from Luke's narrative next week that Joseph and Mary had gone to Bethlehem to register for the Roman census, and Jesus was born while they were there. So the priest got that bit right. There's a telling little phrase in verse 3. Herod was disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. Why were they disturbed? Shouldn't they have been excited and overjoyed that the Messiah might have come at last? Should the priests not have rushed off to Bethlehem to search for themselves? Instead, Herod tries to trick the Magi and sends them to find the baby, telling them to report back to him. He's also careful to find out exactly when the star first appeared, so he can calculate how old the baby would be by now. I wonder whether the Magi were feeling a bit puzzled by now. They'd gone to find a king of the Jews, but no one in Judea seemed to know anything about it. They had travelled many hundreds of miles, but now they had a precise location, just a few miles distant, and no one was volunteering to go with them. Then, just at this moment, the star comes into play again. It may not have been visible during their journey, and now reappeared. Or they may have been watching it all along, but now observed a change. But the star went ahead of them and stopped over the place where the child was. I don't understand this bit. How can a star up in the sky pinpoint such an exact location? But the Magi understood, and they were overjoyed. This is where the joy comes in. The translation should be thrilled with ecstatic joy. They were absolutely beside themselves. Here was confirmation that they were in the right place, and the quest had not been a foolish one after all. So the travellers came to the house, not, you notice, the stable. So there must have been room in the inn by now. There was the child they had come all those miles to see. They bowed down and worshipped him. Worship. When you pay homage to a king, but worship is for deity. Did the Magi understand that this was no ordinary king, but the Son of God himself? Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts. But what strange gifts to give to a small child. You've probably heard the joke that the Magi can't have been women, as they would have brought a supply of disposable nappies. But the Magi brought unusual gifts. Like the 12 days of Christmas, they seem to get odder as they go on. And the first gift was gold. Now, that's a suitable gift to give to a king in any age, or anyone else for that matter. Gold has always been a precious metal. It was rare, and so it was precious. It's also convertible. Currencies may fluctuate, but gold keeps its value. It's usually acceptable in payment anywhere. So gold was actually going to be quite useful for Mary and Joseph. They didn't know it yet, but they were about to travel to Egypt. How could Joseph support his family while he was there? Presumably all his carpentry tools had been left behind in Nazareth, so he couldn't carry on his trade. But the gold would cover their costs until they could return home. There's a lot of gold changing hands at Christmas time. People buy lots of food, presents for each other, trees and decorations. Neighbours try to outdo each other as to who has the best display of lights on their house. The shops start displaying Christmas goods as early as September. And the message is all spend, spend, spend. But is that the real meaning of Christmas? The second gift is frankincense. And that's what frankincense looks like, apparently. I had to look it up in the dictionary. It's a gum resin obtained from certain trees which grow in southern Arabia and Somalia. And it's been produced in Oman for nearly 9,000 years. It was exported to Persia as well as Europe, India and China. And when it's burnt, it gives off a lovely smell. So it's used to make incense, which more than one religion uses as an offering to God. It's mentioned in Exodus as one of the ingredients of the incense which was used in the tabernacle. And it too has always been of great value, even worth its weight in gold. It's recorded that the Romans sent an army to Arabia to find the source of frankincense so that they could get control of it. And recently it's been discovered that frankincense can help to ease arthritis, and it even appears in cancer treatment, which will make it even more valuable. So again, it's a suitable gift to take to a king. Christmas is full of lovely smells. Turkey roasting, mulled wine, pine from real Christmas trees, logs burning in a fire. It's a time of feasting and parties and people having a good time. Or at least that's the image we have of the ideal Christmas. But is that the real meaning of Christmas? The third gift is myrrh. And that's what that looks like. But it's another mysterious substance which I had to look up. It's rather similar to frankincense in that it is a resin obtained from a tree. Myrrh trees also grow in North Africa and Arabia. But whereas frankincense is a sweet, fragrant perfume, myrrh is bitter. It's processed into an oil which can be used as a skin treatment, which is said to reduce signs of aging. And it's also one of the beauty treatments mentioned in the Book of Esther. The ancient Egyptians used it to cure hay fever. But in Somalia, a little bit of myrrh is placed under the cot of a new baby and left there for a year, because they believe it helps the baby. But it has also been used in religious ceremonies from ancient times. So it's sometimes called a holy oil, and it's often associated with burial and funeral rites. Well, there's lots of religious ceremonies at Christmas. Nativity plays, carol services, Christingle services, watch night services on Christmas night. At Hebron, we have carols by candlelight next Sunday, when all the lights are put out and the church is just lit by flickering candles. It's a magical time. But is even that the real meaning of Christmas? There's a fourth gift. Gold is a symbol of kingship on earth. Frankincense is a symbol of deity. But myrrh is a symbol of death. I wonder if the Magi realized the significance of their gifts. As the old hymn puts it, this baby was king and God and sacrifice. They certainly came to find a king. Where is the one who has been born, king of the Jews? They seem to have understood that he was more than a king. We have come to worship him. But why the myrrh? Back to T.S. Eliot's poem. Were we led all that way for birth or death? There was a birth, certainly. We had evidence and no doubt. I had seen birth and death, but had thought they were different. And so we begin to see a fourth gift, something the Magi did not bring. The gift of myrrh was symbolic of what was to come. The baby they came to see would become the man on the cross. He would grow up to be Jesus, the teacher and healer. He was born to be the savior of the world, and this would be accomplished through his death on the cross. This gift brings us right to the heart of Christmas, and it is a gift to us, to our world, from God himself. John 3:16, "For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish, but have eternal life." Here is a gift far more valuable than gold or frankincense or myrrh. Here is a gift which doesn't just last till the box of chocolates is empty or the batteries on the child's toy have run down. It lasts forever. Here is a gift which costs us nothing, but which costs the Son of God everything. Here is a gift, not for a select few, but for everyone. You've only to believe, and the gift is yours. I hope you will take it this Christmas. So now we come to the last section of our passage today, the Great Escape. Sorry about the picture, I couldn't resist that one. But actually there were two escapes. The Magi were supposed to go back to Herod and tell him where the baby was. But it says they were warned in a dream not to do this. No signs in the sky this time. It was a direct message from God. So they slipped away quietly and got out of the country before Herod knew it. They've obviously upgraded their transport by now. But as Matthew says, they outwitted Herod and he was furious. Then Joseph had a dream too. And he also received a warning to get away quickly. He was told specifically to take Jesus and Mary to Egypt and stay there until further notice. I think Joseph must have been getting quite used to angels appearing in his dreams. Last week in Matthew chapter 1, we read that an angel told him to go ahead and marry Mary. Once again, he was obedient. And the family quietly disappeared during the night. Herod reacted as one might expect from such a ruthless and cruel man. He could not identify this particular child who he saw as a threat to his own position. So he ordered the murder of all male children in the Bethlehem area under the age of 2 years. He'd worked out how old the child must be from the information supplied by the Magi, and no doubt added a bit just to be on the safe side. If he killed all the boys of that age and under, he was bound to include the right one. But God knew what was in Herod's heart, and his purpose was thwarted. There would be other attempts on the life of Jesus, as the evil one sought to frustrate God's plan of salvation, but this was just the first. One day, Jesus would die by order of the rulers of Judea, but that time was not yet. This verse turned up in my head while I was thinking about this talk. It's in Job chapter 11, and it's spoken, probably ironically, by one of his friends. That's the rendering of the question in the King James Version. Other translations put it slightly differently, but the thought is that no man can probe the mind of God or his mysteries. But Job refutes this and says that even the animals and the birds and the earth itself will teach men about God. And this was echoed by the Apostle Paul in Romans 1, where he says, "For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse." So the Magi, in searching the heavens, were observers of God's power. As David puts it in Psalm 19, "The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day they pour forth speech. Night after night they display knowledge. There's no speech or language where their voice is not heard. Their voice goes out into all the earth, their words to the end of the world." These men, as far as we know, were Gentiles. They did not worship the God of Israel. They did not have the writings of Moses or the prophets to guide them. Yet they saw something in the stars which sent them on their journey to find the Saviour. And they were filled with joy as they approached the fulfillment of their quest. When they saw the king, small child as he was, they fell down and worshipped him. The Jews, on the other hand, had all the scriptures and the teachings of the rabbis and a long history of God dealing directly with his people. They were expecting the Messiah. Even the Samaritan woman who met Jesus at the well knew about the Messiah. Even Herod was instantly alert to the possibility. And yet, the people of Jerusalem were disturbed at the suggestion that the Messiah had indeed come. Herod tried to destroy him. The people did nothing. So I think the Magi would definitely say that you can, by searching, find out God. If you want to search for him, then reading one of the Gospels is a good place to start. And if you do start searching, then God has given you a promise through the prophet Jeremiah. You will seek me and find me when you seek me with all your heart.